Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Yep, I'm back again. Anyway, at the back end of the show, we're going to be listening to an excerpt from the dialogue between Bob Avakian and Cornel West. And the name of that dialogue is Revolution and Religion, The Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion, a dialogue between Bob Avakian and Cornel West. And this is a response that they gave to the question, why are we still fighting for justice in 2015? And that is the big question. All right. So if you haven't been asking yourself that question, you better start looking at why not. All right. That's the thing, because quite frankly, if we live in a society like we're doing today and we're not questioning and we're not standing up and resisting all this stuff, then basically we're saying that all that they do, all the horrors they bring down on the people of the world and on the world itself are okay. And quite bluntly, it's not okay. Opening the show up, however, I'm very, very happy that we're able to present an interview with Andy Z of Revolution Books and co-director of the new film that premiered on March 28th, Revolution and Religion, Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion, a film of a dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian. And we're going to be talking with Andy Z and Annie Day of the Bob Avakian Institute and also a co-producer of the film. And I'm not going to say much more because I pre-recorded this interview and I really think you're going to like it. So stay tuned. Check this out. Back in November of 2014, there was a very powerful dialogue that occurred at Riverside Church in New York City. It was titled Revolution and Religion, The Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion, a dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian. And for people who are regular listeners to this show, you know, you've probably heard us talking about it. You may have heard excerpts from the audio of it. But right now, this dialogue has been made into a very powerful film. And it is having its national premiere and its online launch on March 28th, all over the country. And basically, I was very excited about this, and I wanted to talk with people about it, so I'm very pleased to welcome to the show Andy Z. Andy is the spokesperson for Revolution Books in New York City, and he's the director of the film of the dialogue by the same name, Revolution and Religion, The Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion, a dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian. And I'm also pleased to welcome to the show Annie Day. Annie is co-producer of the film, and she's also from the Bob Avakian Institute, which, along with Revolution Books in New York City, sponsored the dialogue back in November. Andy, Annie, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. Good to be here.
All right, let's jump into this, because I want to squeeze as much out of it as I can in terms of time. Andy, you seem best positioned to talk about this. Tell people what the film is about.
Well, just first off, I want to say that I co-directed the film with David Zeiger, a documentary filmmaker in L.A. who did the movie Sir, No Sir. We worked on this together. The film is 3 hours and 54 minutes. It is an actual documentary of the event that happened at Riverside Church. You get a sense of the presentations of both of the participants, Cornel West and Bob Avakian, and the exchange between them. And you also get a sense of the incredible audience that was in the room, 1,900 people, people from Ferguson, from the ghettos and barrios of the South, of Chicago, New York. People flew in from L.A., as well as people from all strata, including famous musicians, actors, as well as all kinds of people from different strata. And what the film is about is a dialogue on a revolution and the emancipation of humanity. And at this moment in time, and it takes up that question of revolution in relationship to religion. What is the role of religion in the process, in the fight for human emancipation? And so that's the subject matter of the film, and well, we can talk further about it, but they get into these questions in a lot of depth, and hopefully we can get a chance to talk about some of this and why it matters.
Sure. And Annie, I forgot to mention that you were also the MC of the event, which was actually a very important role you played there. And in terms of going out and popularizing the event before it happened, the actual dialogue back in November, you also spent a lot of time talking with people and sometimes wrestling with people, but also talking with them about the importance of this dialogue. And I wanted you to, you know, talk about something you and I have often talked about, which is the historic character of the dialogue. What is it?
Yeah, well, on a few levels. One, there's sort of never been a coming together of revolutionary leader who's leading a movement for revolution now with a revolutionary Christian. And that alliance, that coming together of forging the deep unity that West and Avakian have, but also a lot of a lot of struggles, an overarching thing of this kind of coming together on this question. And then in the dialogue in particular, what was so historic about it is here you had a public appearance from Bob Avakian and a chance to see him speak live and in person. And this is somebody who's, you know, there's people who make big breakthroughs in their field of endeavor throughout all of human history, and there, you know, have been and there will be more. And Avakian is somebody who's made tremendous breakthroughs in a whole new conception of communist revolution and a whole new conception of a whole different way the world could be. And so here he was in dialogue with Cornel West, who's a, you know, a really honest and principled, prominent intellectual who's never backed down from standing with the people of the world and challenging others to do the same. And so here they were sharing a stage together and doing it on a question that is right now impacting the lives of millions of people all around the world. And so all of the way that came together, it's never been done before. It really was truly historic. And then once you were in the room, that character really, you felt it on a whole deeper level, the response and the relationship of the audience to both speakers. The you know, most people were just on the edge of their seats and you could feel it. I had the opportunity to watch the audience from the stage and people just standing up and cheering and clapping at key points all throughout it because they were touched so deeply to their souls with people calling out the misery that they have to face in the society, but also pointing to a whole different way the world could be. And you know, and again, struggling through with a lot of unity about that and then struggling through their difference, and it tapped into something very deep. And I think the film can on a whole other level.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting because I went to the simulcast here in Los Angeles, and it was amazing when you turned around and you looked at the room and the people who were in there, and it seemed, sort of mirrored what you're talking about in terms of the people who came to this event, but, you know, to the actual event in New York. But there was also something that I saw that you were just speaking to, which is, you know, this point about what it struck in people who often I've had conversations with them often, and they would, you know, either get a little bit, a tiny spot of cynicism when they're talking about what they wish was possible or what they wish could happen, but then they get a tiny bit of cynicism when you're talking about, well, it can. And I actually saw people there who were just glued, their eyes and their ears were just glued to what was being said, you know, during the simulcast from the stage in New York. People who actually, you know, I didn't think actually, you know, and it was probably on me because I thought like, well, this guy, every time he shifted, I thought, well, he's getting ready to get up and go. But he was actually shifting so he could actually hear better or he could get, you know, get into it a little bit more. And it was across the board, it seemed to have that kind of impact on people, which is very, very good. I don't know if you want to say anything about that, but it also has something to do with the participants in the dialogue and the moment that this all occurred in.
Yeah, I think that's important, Michael. This dialogue happened on November 15th. This was just days before the grand jury findings were released in St. Louis, where the murderer of Michael Brell is let off without even an indictment, without even bringing it before a jury. And then just a week after this, there was the non-indictment in Staten Island, New York, of the police murderer of Eric Garner. So this was present in the room on top of everything else that people are feeling, the whole culture of rape and degradation of women, the devastation of the environment, the international situation, and all of this has only gotten worse. And what was so unique about this and why it so much matters now that people come to these premieres and also get online and get thousands and tens of thousands more to listen to this is that both of these speakers came from a place of deep morality from different philosophical and epistemological points of view, which means how they understand the world, but they both came from a very common place of saying it is unacceptable and unconscionable to accept this way of life that does this kind of degradation, devastation, and outright killing of our youth, including among the black youth and Latin youth who are being shot down by the police of this country at the rate of more than one a day, including that this is the beginning of a slow genocide, and it really must be stopped. And what's extraordinary here, and I think what affected people and why they were at the edge of their seat, is because of this tremendous morality and unaccepting of this situation by both speakers. But in Avakian's presentation, he really brought out to people that this is not an anomaly, it's not a peculiarity, it's not just bad ideas among a few people, but this oppression of black and Latino people and these divisions in society are intrinsic in the system of capitalism and imperialism. And Avakian has spent his whole life getting into this and digging out what are the root causes of this and showing people how it is not necessary for this to go on any longer, how it is possible to actually make a revolution, as he puts it, drawing from the 60s, in here in the belly of the beast. What's the strategy and plan for that? People got a sense of that in this room, and they were gripped. They hadn't heard anybody else talk about it. Nobody's been talking about this for years. And more than that, he actually presented a different vision of a radically different world in a section of the speech that's called the What Ifs, and people can watch this now in a short YouTube clip to get ready for Saturday's premiere online at revcom.us. But I think that, you know, what Andy brought out, and just let me finish this comment with this, is that people have to realize what it means that people put up with this stuff every day. My God, if you watch the assault at the University of Virginia of Martise Johnson, it just made your blood boil. And then to have somebody be able to break down for you why this happens and how it could be radically transformed through a different social system and government coming about through revolution, how that is possible and what it could bring about for a community of humanity around the world, why, that's extraordinary. It's what's needed, and people've never heard it before. And that's what really gets delivered in this film through Bakian and through the exchange with Cornell, which we can get into more, what they were talking about and disagreeing about in terms of religion and how they and the synthesis they had between each other.
Mm-hmm. Annie, did you want to comment on that?
Yeah, just on one part of it. I think it's what Andy's saying is really important. And I guess I was recently talking with a young woman from the Revolution Club here in L.A., and she was commenting on this false idea people say of, oh, if you just by suffering through the oppression you face, so you automatically understand it. And just what Andy was saying about how in a Bakian speech, in the dialogue, he breaks down why this keeps happening to people again and again and again, and what's the basis to do away with it once and for all. We don't have to keep living this way. And she was commenting, this young woman from the Revolution Club was commenting, I'd really like to invite anybody and everybody who thinks that that's the case to come out with us to the neighborhoods of the oppressed. And you'll see all the ways people, they don't understand. I mean, you can learn a lot from people about what they have to suffer through and what it's like to live in a situation where people are constantly degrading each other and being degraded by this system of brutality. Mm. But they don't understand why it's happening. You actually need a scientific viewpoint to understand that. You need a scientific understanding and a scientific method where you're looking to reality and the deeper levels of reality to understand that. All that comes through in a Bakian speech, and I think really an important part of why people should see this dialogue. And then it's also, again, an important part of the struggle between a Bakian and West, where they have differences on what's the method to go at understanding the world.
Well, let's talk about the topic, revolution and religion. If you're thinking about it just spontaneously, when you take a minute and you think about the combination of those two subjects, then you actually begin to see something that's like something very different, something very important. But it was really in the course of listening to both of the speakers, but also reading up about it, listening, talking with people beforehand. This was actually quite the question in people's lives, and especially today, because I do think it's true. The equation is changing. What people are facing, the whole idea of what's going on, that the system has no answers, is becoming more and more profoundly stated in what they're doing, what they continue to do. But the idea that actually people talked about revolution and religion, the two speakers talked about revolution and religion, and that's what was going on there, and why, how it manifested itself and its relationship to actually getting people involved, people getting involved in a revolutionary movement.
Yeah, well, look, the topic is really important because from a revolutionary point of view, from a Bakian's point of view, from a dialectical materialist point of view, from a scientific point of view, if people don't understand the world as it actually is, sooner or later, they're going to run into a problem with being able to change that world. And Cornell brought out very movingly, forcefully, that for him, religion is, as he put it, in the skin. It's how he and many other black people have been able to get through the night, the long night of slavery and Jim Crow and now the new Jim Crow and a slow genocide. And so that's a different way of approaching the world. Now, in Cornell's case, it leads him, his conviction, his faith, his way of looking, where it leads him to not actually tolerate the world as it is, but to fight against oppression. And this is where they come together. It also leads him to, along with the Bakian, to believe that those who are, as he's put it many times, the least of these can actually transform themselves and transform the world. But they are struggling over this because it's been the experience of building a movement for revolution here and around the world that if people don't have an understanding of the way the world actually takes place, what are the material factors that go into it, What are the underlying contradictions in terms of how society produces what it needs to live? Well, if you don't understand all of this, you can't actually remake the world in a way that will be liberatory and emancipatory for all of humanity. So they engaged us and struggled over it, but each coming from the point of view of it is intolerable as it is and it must be changed. And I think the one thing I do want to say now, as much as Annie and I are going to try to give people a taste of this, that people do need to see the film. And some people may say, well, it's over it's almost 4 hours. That's a long time. Well, it's not a long time if it can give you a way out of a long time we've had to deal with this world. And so it's well worth the time. In fact, it's well worth it many times. As the co-director, I've seen this film dozens of times, and every time I learn something new. And I really do want to encourage people to come out and see it and experience it with others who will hopefully and most likely be shouting back at the screen and applauding and shaking their heads. And that's a collective experience that people don't want to miss.
Annie, there's something I wanted to ask you in relation to what we've just been talking about, the transgressions and convergence that was modeled during the dialogue. You know, and it was also an element of the speakers challenging each other and the audience. And I wanted to ask you this question of modeling. What was modeled there? Because there was a whole, you know, you could have gotten up there and you've seen people just like, you know, the way we're always presented with meaningful debates, or people get up there and they box it out, and especially when in an era of Fox TV and all the rest of this stuff, where you just yell at each other. But these were people who came together to talk about a very serious situation and to talk about seriously changing it. Let's talk about that a little. What was modeled in the relationship between the two participants?
Yeah, I think you just spoke to it, and I think I'll speak to what you're asking. But I do think, just like Andy was saying, I'll say some things about it, but people really need to see it. They need to experience, and there's nothing like coming together with people who, in a space all together where people all want to change the world and get into the questions of how. There's nothing like experiencing it, like, you know, all together in that kind of way in a dark theater. But to speak to your question about what was modeled between West and the Making on that stage, I think you have two people who are so deeply concerned about the suffering that people have to face here and all around the world. The children bombed in Gaza and Yemen, people all over Africa suffering from Ebola unnecessarily, you know, in terms of that there's actually a way to handle this disease, even if we can't cure it, where it doesn't have to ravage so many people so wildly. So deeply concerned about the lives of women and gays and lesbians and trans people here and around the world, and so very, very deeply concerned about putting an end to the police murder and brutality and the way Cornel West calls it, the soul murder of our youth here. They're so deeply concerned about all of that that they come together in unity about how we're going to stop that. And then they struggle with a lot of substance and a lot of principle about what that's going to take. What do we base ourselves in that process? What's possible? What's needed from us in terms of strategy, vision, morality, bearing witness? And so this is what's modeled about how you come together with people with, and this is something I've come to appreciate more recently in getting into this dialogue more myself, the importance of integrity, the importance of morality, that it's not just, okay, well, we want to change the world, so whatever it takes to do that, we're going to come together and do that. And then people are dishonest, or they base themselves on, oh, well, whatever people think, that'll work, or whatever will get over in the short run, that'll work. No, we have to base ourselves on integrity, on principle, on morals that are in line with where we're trying to go. And that's something that both Cornel West and Bob Avakian have in common. And they share that, and then they model that. And then you see a lot of love and a lot of struggle and a lot of laughter. Even as they don't hold back from what they disagree on. And I think that's what's modeled. And it's a different way. It is a different way to be. It is a different way to come together and fight, both against what we have to fight against, but also what we have to fight for in terms of a whole new world and a whole new way that people can come together in that world.
Well, let me first remind people that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Andy Z, the director of the film on the dialogue Revolution and Religion, The Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion, a dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian. And we're also talking with Annie Day, who was a co-producer of the film, and she is also from the Bob Avakian Institute. Now, let me ask you this, and maybe I can start with Annie, and then Andy, you can join in this a little bit later. Annie, you know, you talked about having a certain perspective and being able to really see the audience during the whole event. And I looked at that, and there was something, I know that, again, in the simulcast, there was something that changed in the grouping I saw it with, in terms of people coming together as a different whole. You know, they came into things in a certain sense with being, you know, individuals who were there to check it out, or maybe they had some contact with people. But there was something that began to bubble and be created there. And I think, having read the questions and just seen what I've seen of the audience in the trailer for the film, you know, there was something very, very important that was formed there. And I wanted you to talk about the audience, what that brought to the film, and what happened there.
Well, I think it got expressed in one of the questions that we asked from the stage. People in the audience wrote in questions. We were only able to get to a few of them. And you can see a number of them online at revcom.us, where you can also see people's comments about the dialogue. But I think that, you know, sort of what got forged in the audience is reflected in a question that we read on the stage about, I wish that life could be like what's in this room every day. And then they talked about, look, it's hard when you go out there, where you run up against the fact that people have hardened their hearts and that there is so much cynicism. And they asked the question about how do we replicate what there is today, but also how do we make it through this world? And I think that's where you have people, again, that are coming all together and very unique. You rarely, I don't know any other events where you bring together PhDs and high-level academics and prominent artists with people from the projects, and they're sitting right up next to each other. We did a special commendation for people when we opened the dialogue, where we gave special recognition to people who were there whose parents were killed by the police and have been fighting against police murder, people who whose children are in Rikers Island prison because they got caught up in these anti-gang raids, which was really just a way to criminalize and brutalize our youth, people who were there who were former prisoners, people who were there, you know, like I said, who were academics and prominent people in their fields and professionals. Hundreds of students were there from outlying areas and other cities, but lots and lots from New York City. And there was something very special that got forged. Look, you know, you have 1,900 people. There's going to be a lot of differences. There's going to be a lot of struggle. Not everyone's going to all agree, and not everyone's going to all like it. But really what got forged there was a very special coming together of a whole range of kinds of people who wanted to really figure out how we're going to get free and wanted to hear these two people get into the answers. Again, that comes through in the film, that comes where you get to see some of the audience reaction. But even more, it's a film that people need to see, because what got spread there, I mean, you know, there's nothing like being in a live event. But I think what the film captures, it's not trying to do what the live event did, but it takes you inside in a different kind of way, where you get up close with Avakian and West as they each give their presentations and as they come together in dialogue. And this really does need to be seen and spread, because that has to get replicated over and over and over again to thousands and hundreds of thousands online and then in these premier events nationally this Saturday.
Yeah. Andy, do you have any comments on this question of the audience? Because I think it is an important question here.
Yeah, I just want to bring out one dimension of it. I thought Andy said it was right on and all that. But I think we should understand that one of the hallmarks of Avakian's work, and actually it's a big part of what this revolution to emancipate all of humanity is predicated upon, that those who this system despises, those who this system treats as nothing, have the potential, as part of changing the world, to change themselves and actually become the emancipators of humanity. A former prisoner who was at the dialogue and was sitting up in the balcony and has talked about how when Avakian talked about a vision of a different world that I mentioned before, the what ifs, he said that he and others around him were in tears. He also said that, and this is on our website, people the system says are the worst of the worst can change and be a part of this. If you don't get that part, you're missing a big part of what Bob Avakian's speech is about. And I think that Cornell shares a good deal of this. In other words, the people, these two people were not speaking on the stage out of pity, compassion, hand-wringing about those on the bottom of the society. They were struggling with people to rise up and out of the muck and mire that people get caught in fighting each other over nonsense, the misbeliefs and disbeliefs and all these kinds of things, the mental traps that people are caught in, that are put upon them by the system. They were struggling for people to rise up and be what they could be. And I was reading also on the website that some women, what they call Skid Row in Los Angeles, where you guys are, were viewing the trailer of the film, and they watched it, and they said that, you know, people just think of all of them in that place as nothing, as drunks or drug addicts and all this. And these women said that they saw this, and they were very moved because it actually brought forward to them that there is a way out. And I think that what you sensed in the audience there was an audience as a whole that was appreciating and coming to recognize and grappling with that it doesn't have to be this way and there is a way out, and that became particularly vocally expressed by those who are trapped in the bottom of society, who were feeling that they were being not just valued, but that they were being challenged to actually rise up and be rid of this. And they had their disillusion and their illusions were being challenged, and they felt empowered in that situation, and that moved the whole room. And we hopefully can convey, or did convey, some of this response of the audience in the film. You can hear them, sometimes you get to see them, but you also have an opportunity of watching a film that most in the audience did not have, which is that you're way up close in what Brother Avakian and Brother West are doing, and so that you're really inside this conversation and can see this potential that people felt in the house.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's really true. Just even in watching the trailer, it's like a very different experience, you know, because I was looking at it and I was thinking, wow, you know, in terms of watching how these two people are interacting with one another, the seriousness with which they take what the other person is saying, and the way that they're actually thinking about that, and you can see a lot of the process that's going on and that we talked about as being modeled there, but see the process actually unfold. And then also the thing of in the trailer, the conversations that are held with people coming into the event and what they're saying about why they're there and what's going on and what made them feel compelled to be there. I thought that was really an indication, having not seen the film, an indication of that was in the trailer. And it made me really be anxious about seeing the film. So let's hurry up and get it out there.
Hey, Michael, if I could just interject. Look, I'm not apologizing for really promoting what we have in this film, not just because I had something to do with making it or not just because it's what I believe in, but because this is actually what people need. But this trailer should be sent out everywhere. There should be thousands and thousands of people seeing it in the next few days. You know, there was a middle-class black guy, as I understand it, in Houston, Texas, who people came up and they were going door-to-door, and this guy would say, hey, look, man, I just don't want to hear anymore about the police killing black people. It makes me too angry. Here's $14, and I appreciate what you guys are doing. They said, well, just watch this trailer. They played the trailer. He got about halfway through it, and he said, stop. And he pulled out $40 and said, give me two tickets. I'm coming to the film. It's that powerful. I think we need to get this out all over the place, and people who are hearing your radio show today for the first time need to be spreading this trailer. It's online at revcom.us. You got right on the front page there, and get it around, because it is speaking to the anguish and the agony as well as the hopes and desires of just millions of people right now. And it is very much part of changing the whole atmosphere and standing up against all this. And I guess we're on the radio, all the bad stuff that's going on. That feels much too mild for me, but we'll leave it at that.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Annie, we're running out of time. We've got about 6 or 7 minutes left. I want you to talk about the BA Institute, the Bob Avakian Institute, one of the sponsors of the dialogue, and you're part of that. And it's important that people know about that, I think. So this is a chance to actually talk about it for a while.
The Bob Avakian Institute is an educational nonprofit that is dedicated to promoting, preserving, and projecting the body of work and vision of Bob Avakian throughout every corner of society. You know, over 40 years, Avakian has developed a very extensive and profound, provocative, political, philosophical, ideological synthesis of communism, but also then on that basis and as part of that, speaking to a whole range of questions having to do with understanding the development of human society and understanding nature and how we're going to get free. And so this institute is dedicated to making that known throughout every corner of society. So as part of that, we co-produced this dialogue, which we were very honored and excited to do. But also we've just published a compendium of work from Avakian, but also from the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic in North America, which is a piece from the Revolutionary Communist Party, but it's based on Avakian's new synthesis of communism, and it is a concrete and sweeping framework for a whole different state power. So this compilation that we've just published online, we'll be publishing in print soon, is called Constitution, Law, and Rights in Capitalist Society and in the Future Socialist Society. It's a very, very deep compendium of work that speaks to profound questions of how human society is organized and how it should be organized and what that's based on. And it also kind of challenges people's deepest fundamental assumptions about the ideals of democracy and whether or not, as Avakian argues, we can and must do better than that. You know, this is a part of a body of work of Avakian, of somebody who, after the first stage of communist revolution ended, after it was defeated, Avakian put himself to studying the lived experience of hundreds of millions of people who made revolution. You know, they made tremendous advances in these societies towards human emancipation in really inspiring ways, but was defeated. And then in looking at all that, looking at all those advances, he also didn't shy away from just confronting where they fell short, what was wrong in their understanding, what were the mistakes, even grievous mistakes, that were made in that process. And putting all this together, going deeply into this experience, and also looking at the developments in human society more broadly, in science and in questions of art and culture, he's brought forward a new synthesis of communism. And I just don't think people should, I think it would be a profound mistake to underestimate the significance of this and what it opens up for humanity, that there really is a different way we could live. There's a strategy to go at that, and this is what's concentrated in Avakian's work. It is a whole new a stage of communist revolution and a whole new conception for a different way the world could be, and this is what people I think should be getting into and why they should support the work of the Bob Avakian Institute to make this known, to make this engaged and become a point of reference in society and a point of debate and a point of contention. So that's what the Institute is, and people should support it. People should find out about it. You can go to our website at thebobavakianinstitute.org and find out more about what we've done and how they can be part of it.
All right, and we're going to have to close in the next couple of minutes, but I wanted to give each of you a chance if there's anything else you wanted to say about the film and the subjects we've been talking about.
Well, I'll try to be brief, but I was reading in this morning's New York Times an article. It's actually about the sexual assault and the situation at the University of Virginia, and I think it's a young woman who was talking about, and this is where that young man was beaten by the police just for being black, an honor student, all of that came out of Kenwood High in Chicago. And she said, you know, we really have a very good community, but somehow these bad things just keep happening. And unfortunately, I think that's a viewpoint of a lot of people. These bad things just keep happening. I don't understand why, and I should just be able to live my life as a white middle-class student. And I think if you watch this film, you get a sense of why this is happening. You get a picture that's scathing, deep, profound, provocative of why this stuff keeps happening. What is intrinsic in this country? Why it is that, as Avakianist said, that there would be no United States as we know it today without slavery. That's a simple and basic truth. You get a living feeling for this, and it's intolerable, and you get a moral indignation at this from both Cornel West and Avakian. You get from each of them that it's unacceptable to accept this, it's unconscionable, and that you have to act against it, and you get a way out. Cornel points to that in Avakian's work and in the work of the Revolutionary Communist Party. Cornel himself argues for people to fight for a way out. And people get, in this film, a taste of what the strategy is to make a revolution, what that vision is, and in a time like this, for people, anybody in this society with a conscience, and especially for those on the bottom of society who are bearing the brunt of all this, this is a film about emancipation and liberation and the struggle to get there. And it's modeled on the stage. It's delivered in substance. You feel it in the room. And it's very much needed right now as we're going into a period where it's in this country, it's a big question of, is the movement against this police murder going to stagnate and get turned into something that just keeps the system going, or is it going to rise again in a way that can actually put an end to this genocide against our youth? And I'm pointing here to the actions called for on April 14th, and more than that, towards a movement for revolution where we end this once and for all and bring about the kind of world that actually is fit for human beings. And this is what we're about at Revolution Books. This is what Bob Avakian's work is about. That's why it's so important that there's a BA Institute, and this is what we're doing. So you need to get out there, watch the film, spread it online, and let's go. Let's change the world.
All right. Annie, anything you want to add?
people should see this film. And I would add to what Andy said, I think, quite powerfully. But, you know, if people suffer through the horrors of this system day in and day out and get numb to it, they think this is just the natural order of things. And even when people are straining against that, we see this a lot among the most oppressed in the ghettos and barrios, where people are straining for a better way. They want to come together in unity. They don't like that that the people on the bottom keep killing each other. They know they're getting played by this system on one level with gang beefs that have nothing to do with their fundamental and highest interests. But there's a logic and a code that people have a hard time stepping out of. And you can't fully step out of that if you don't pull the lens back. If you don't ask the questions about why we're in the situation we're in, what can be done about it? And this is, you know, and I think Andy said it, this is what's spoken to in this dialogue, where they go back and forth together on these questions and on the bigger questions and about what kind of people we're going to be. What should our morality be? How should we live our lives? And what kind of people are we going to be? And what kind of world are we going to fight for? And all of that is spoken to in this dialogue on revolution and religion, the fight for emancipation, and the role of religion. And it's something that people all across this country and all around the world need to watch. They need to watch it in groups. They need to come together, discuss it, debate it, and be part of spreading it and sharing it so that people can, even as we're coming together to fight the power, can be changing their thinking and changing their values and debating all those questions. And that's what I would add, especially now at a time when the rulers of this country they're not backed up off the horrors that they're putting on the people here and all around the world, but they're also facing big problems. And especially now, as people are beginning to fight, we have to ask those questions and dig into the answers.
All right. Thank you very much. Andy, Annie, thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael.
Okay. Take care now.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. All right. You've just been listening to an interview with Andy Z, the co-director of the new film that premiered on March 28th, Revolution and Religion, The Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion, a film of a dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian, and Annie Day from the Bob Avakian Institute, and who's also a co-producer of the film. All right. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be listening to an excerpt from the film that we've just been talking about, Revolution and Religion, The Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion, a film of a dialogue between Bob Avakian and Cornel West. And this is an excerpt that's really going to whet your appetite for the whole film, so stay tuned.
Sometimes I wonder just what I'm fighting for. I win some battles, but I always lose the war. I keep right on stumbling in this no man's land out there. But I know, yes, I know, there must be a better world.
All right, welcome back. There Must Be a Better World Somewhere by Irma Thomas. It's just a great, great song. I really love that song, and it actually captures a lot of what we're talking about today. Okay, so what we're going to be listening to now is an excerpt from the film, and this is a response to a Q&A from the audience that was posed to Avakian and West. And the question was, why are we still fighting for justice in 2015?
There's two connected questions that I'm going to ask. One is in the reference to the June 4th raid in Harlem. The question is, how do we as a community approach the NYPD and our city officials to demand justice and free our children now, who are now incarcerated? That's right. They're now incarcerated, all facing conspiracy charges and life in prison. We need help. And then, which is a very powerful question. The second is I think, related, from someone in Ferguson, Missouri,
Right on.
And they asked, why are we in 2015 still going through this hell? Because I never thought I'd be still fighting for justice. So those two questions.
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. Wonderful question. As I said before, though, that there's a sense in which the struggle for freedom is a perennial struggle because there's progress and then regress. For the last 30 years, there's been a class war against poor and working people, disproportionately targeting young folk of color. And the results of that class war has produced what we're dealing with right now. And that was regress. So we had breakthrough on the one hand, we had regress on the other. The breakthrough was one in which you ended up with the expansion of a black professional class and a black middle class and even a few black top dogs in terms of corporate America and Wall Street, you see. But at the same time, it was a devastation of the black working class and an expansion of the black poor who more and more find themselves unable to even find a role in the society in terms of jobs, in terms of status and stature. And that is unbelievable regress. And we're dealing with the consequences of that regress. And so in that sense, you would think, well, my God, 2015, we thought, lo and behold, with Martin King and Fannie Lou Hamer and the others, that we would be able to be closer to black freedom. No, that's not the case at all. That the ruling class in America won the class war over the last 35 years. And we're responding to that triumph from above. And what is wonderful is the degree to which the young folk are willing to fight. Ferguson is just, I think, the beginning. We're going to see a whole wave of activism among the young folk. And the beautiful thing is that the sisters, the black sisters, will play a fundamental role. Yeah, Tef Poe, that's beautiful, but oh, you got Ashley Yates. Oh, yes, you got Tori Russell, but oh, you got Sister Alexis, and on, it's going to be a collective, mutually gendered and trans affair, which was very different than what it was when we were coming along, because we know how deep that patriarchy was. Isn't that the truth, though?
Yeah, it is.
Oh, Lord, indeed. That's why I appreciate your critique of patriarchy, especially for an old school brother like you hitting hard like that. I'm old school, too, but I mean, you'd be surprised.
Well, we have to keep on learning. Right?
Exactly. We got to keep on learning.
Well, I would say, I think these two questions are very much related. I would say the basic answer to the question of why we still have to fight after all this time is because we're still living under the same system. And unless and until we get rid of the system, the same things are going to keep on happening, even if they happen in some different ways. Like I was thinking about Detroit. The most powerful urban rebellion in the 1960s took place in Detroit in 1967. Now, I'm not advocating anything, I'm just telling you the facts. The people rose up in Detroit, and yes, they came in and they killed a lot of them, but they rose up for 5 days. And after they killed them, they said, oh man, we've got a really serious problem here, and they went and started hiring thousands of black people right off the street into the auto plants of Detroit. And those were high-paying jobs. Now, people always, and again, I'm not advocating anything. I'm just telling you the truth when they always say, oh, when people rise up, it doesn't do any good. It never does anything good. All it does is harm, ruin our own communities. They came and they hired thousands of people right off the street. And then they commissioned the Kerner Commission report. Yeah. You remember saying, oh, we've been mistreating black people. Who knew? And they started talking about how they kind of had to make all these changes.
Absolutely.
But now here's the thing. Here we are almost 50 years later. All those jobs that they hired those thousands of people into are gone. Most of the auto plants are closed down. Detroit is a basket case. I don't care they talk about how they got some kind of resolution to the bankruptcy. It's a basket case. Many people in Detroit can't even get water. Decent water, think about that, a large number of people. And that's because it's more profitable, like you were just talking about, for them to close down those plants and to open them in some country where they can force the people to work for much lower wages and to replace people by machines. And when they replace people by machines in this system, they don't go to them and say, oh, we're putting you out of a job, but clearly you need to live, so let us train you for another job. They just say, hit the street, you're gone.
because this is the nature of the system. It's a system driven by ruthless competition among capitalists, which drives them to exploit people and to throw them out of work if they can't exploit them enough to make enough profit.
Absolutely.
So what does that prove? Does it prove that it was wrong for people to rise up in Detroit? No. Does it prove that it's wrong for people to be rising up now? Does it do no good to struggle? You might as well just accept it because they'll just beat you down anyway? No. It's very important that people rise up, that they did so then, and I agree with you. Mm-hmm. We could be on the start of a whole new wave of struggle. But where's it going to go? Are we going to still be facing the same thing 50 years later down the road? Maybe not us, but other people who are coming behind us? Or can we actually get rid of the system and put in place an eager... So that's one question. And I do think it's very much related. The police went raging into these housing projects. This is what they do to our youth all the time. Everybody talks about the prison pipeline from the neighborhood to prison. And this is what they are consciously doing with their mass incarceration, the new Jim Crow that you mentioned, the book by Michelle Alexander. Mm-hmm. This is what they're consciously doing. They put a jacket on these kids from the time they're not even teenagers. And then you've got a record. So now you got a record. Next time you run into the police, they run you through the system, you got a record. You're already heading toward being a felon, being convicted of a felony, and then being sent to prison. And then your whole family is affected by the fact that you're sent to prison. You survive long enough to be sent to prison. So, you know, these raids they carry out, charging conspiracy, they're going and they're taking the social media of these youth. You know how youth are. You're talking about gangster proclivities, you know. youth, they like to talk big, they like to talk bad, you know. I'm going to do this to you, I'm going to do that to you. They took all that stuff as if it were meant literally and said, this is all, you know, just talking bad on the social media and acted as if this were actually concrete conspiracies that they were waging to go out and kill a bunch of people and sell drugs. I mean, you could take almost any rap song and they do that too. And convict a rapper of conspiracy to commit all kinds of crimes because that's what they often talk about in a rap. So where's your artistic freedom? Where's the freedom for these youth to express? They don't even, look, you know, I've often thought, sometimes walking down the street, and I have something in my pocket, and I've often thought as I pull out of my pocket, if I were black, I might be dead now. Because I pulled something out of my pocket that could be construed to look like a gun or some kind of weapon. You don't have, they've got these youth in the inner cities are under a state of siege where all the rights that we're told we have, they don't have. They don't even have the right to express themselves through social media. We cannot accept this. This can't go down. And we've got to go out among not just the people who are directly to answer the question about what do we do about this. We can't just go out among the people who are directly affected by this. We have to go out broadly into society. We have to go out among all the diverse kind of people who are represented here tonight and say, you have to know about what is going on in this country of yours, in this society, where supposedly we have a democracy and supposedly we have rights for the people. But if you live in a certain part of town and you're a certain color and you're looked at by the system in a certain way, you don't have any of even those supposed rights. And we cannot allow that to go on. It's our responsibility.
That's right.
It's our party's responsibility. And I'm determined that we live up to our responsibility, but it's also everybody's responsibility to go broadly. We got to go to the students. In the 60s, I was a student in the 60s on the college campus. That's how I got involved in the free speech movement and then working with the Black Panther Party and fighting against the Vietnam War. Why? Because when you get into when you're a student, I know a lot of them waste their time on nonsense, but at least when you're a student in college, you have the opportunity to learn about a lot of things if you want to do so and you take some initiative to do so. You have ideas that you can work with. You have the life of the mind that you can pursue if you have a mind to do it. And in the 60s, a lot of students did that. They looked at the world around them. Like I said, they saw people rising up and they said, I want to know what this is about. I want to understand this.
But I think in the 60s, we had something else too. And this is a result of the cultural and spiritual war that went hand in hand with the class war. That when we turned on the radio and heard the voice of a David Ruffin, or when we turned on the radio and heard Sheila and Wanda Hutchison of the Emotions singing, there was a tenderness and a sweetness and a kindness that is the raw stuff of any kind of movement.
Right.
Whereas today, you know, it's say my name, as opposed to try a little tenderness, old as Redden. It's hard to find tenderness, sweetness, and kindness. Same is true in terms of the collectivities. You see, when we turned on the radio, who did we hear? We heard the Delphonics and the Dramatics. We heard Enchantment. You see, we heard Lakeside. We heard Ohio Players. Heaven Must Be Like This and Skin Tight. We heard a tenderness and a sweetness. When they turn on the radio today with the oligarchs and plutocrats, the same ones who control recording and radio and video and live performance. That's exactly right though, brother. I love that. It's a cultural, spiritual kind of COMINTELPRO. If somehow we can make sure that the precious souls of young black people, and of course by young black people, you're talking about all folk, because young people have been Afro-Americanized since Motown, since the Funkadelic, since James Brown. So if we can keep their souls so chilly, and I see this in teaching in prisons for 37 years, I can see the shift in it. To keep the soul so chilly, the conscience so coarsened, and the heart so hardened that you don't have the raw stuff for a movement. People can't wait just to get over, to manipulate and dominate or be obsessed with the 11th commandment, thou shalt not get caught. Because everybody's just trying to get over by any means. That's Wall Street. Not one Wall Street executive went to jail given all the crimes that took place in 2008. They didn't get caught yet. But that sends the same kind of sign in the young folk. But again, when you talk about black people, you got to talk about our spirits and our souls and bodies, as well as the organizing and mobilizing, or we'll never be able to pull it off.
Yeah, well, I agree. I think that,
you see what I mean? Okay.
Yeah, I do. I agree. I think that culture is very important. I mean, if you go back to the beginnings of hip-hop and you leave aside sort of silly things like Rapper's Delight or whatever, you know, which had a nice beat, but it wasn't about much.
And a brother just died too, you know.
Yeah.
That brother just died. God bless his soul.
But then you got, you know, Melly Mel.
Grandmaster Flash and the Furious
Grandmaster
Five.
Flash, Melly Mel. Then you got Public Enemy with Chuck D.
KRS-One.
And they were.
Wu-Tang Clan.
They were talking about something.
Oh, yes.
And what happened? The people who control things in the music industry and in general came in and said, we don't want that.
Right.
Ice-T went from being cop killer to being a cop on TV. And they said, This is the way you want to make it. This is the way you make it. All the rest of that stuff, we're going to push that aside and not let it flourish. So, but I think what's happening now, when you talk about a new wave, when you have a new wave of struggle, it brings forward or can bring forward a new culture. And I agree with you. I mean, I grew up on those songs that had tenderness and love too. You know, it's very
rich,
different.
Rich stuff.
It's not weak to love. I think that's something very important.
That's exactly right.
It is not weak to love. It is not weak to treat other people as human beings. And we need a culture that grows together with the actual struggle and is a crucial part of the struggle that promotes the kind of values you're talking about, that promotes looking out for each other and being together and seeing what we have in common instead of trying to get over on each other. And I believe, I forget his, I can't call his name right.
Johannes Hernandez. Give it up for Sister Johannes Hernandez, leader of the Mumias Bujamal movement along with Mark Taylor. We love you. We love you, Johannes. We love you, Johannes. Love you though, sister. No, I'm sorry to take
it. No, that's all right. No, we got
to
pay respect.
Yeah,
but,
that's true.
I can't call his name, but I know there was a rapper recently who did, after the assassination of Michael Brown, came out with a song about that. I can't remember. There you go. Right? Now, that's just, you know, that's an example of what happens. It wasn't just here's the important thing, I think. It wasn't just because yet another black or brown youth was killed in cold blood. It's because people stood up and said, no, we don't care.
Right.
We're not taking this anymore.
That's right.
And that's what inspired a little spark of a new culture. And the more that that happens, the more that we can bring forward that culture. And I agree, we need that culture.
Oh, yeah.
I do agree. I may not agree we need to get it from God, but I agree that we need soul and we need heart.
I agree. I mean, the wonderful thing is that God doesn't ask for your permission. I'm just playing with you.
Well, if I ever hear God asking for my permission, I might change my view.
Oh, Lord. A lot of people see some divine qualities in the love for the masses that you all have in the party. Now you got to watch it.
Okay, that was Bob Avakian and Cornel West. And we were listening to an excerpt from the new film, Revolution and Religion, The Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion, a dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian. And the title of that excerpt, it was an answer to a Q&A. And the question that was asked was, why are we still fighting for justice in 2015? And that is the big question, all right? So if you haven't been asking yourself that question, you better start looking at why not, all right? That's the thing, because quite frankly, if we live in a society like we're doing today and we're not questioning and we're not standing up and resisting all this stuff, then basically we're saying that all that they do, all the horrors they bring down on the people of the world and on the world itself are okay. And quite bluntly, it's not okay. And for everybody who is interested in pursuing that resistance, on April 14th, there's going to be A14, Stop Business as Usual. We will not go back, no school, no work. Say no more to the system giving a green light to killer cops, all right? And you can go to the Stop Mass Incarceration Network's website, which is stopmassincarceration.net. And once again, if you want to watch the new film, Revolution and Religion, The Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion, a dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian, you can go to revcom.us and watch it till your heart's content. All right, we're going to go super fast with all this. I want to thank all of my guests today. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board offer today, Federico Garcia, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslade@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslade@redfuture.com. We're going to rush out now with what we can squeeze from Baby Huey and Listen to Me.